Hi. My name's Rob Landley, and I... Oh, this cable does not want to stay in at all. And my netbook does not have the little... Right. If it falls out again, let me know. All right. I did free software before I ever heard of Linux. The first free download I put up was a game editor for the Commodore 64 called The Bard's Tale when I was 13 or 14. I used FidoNet, Binkley Term, Z-Modem, Fossil Drivers. I watched PKZip get cloned as InfoZip. I watched PGP get Pretty Good Privacy get cloned as GNU Privacy Guard. I did open source long before I ever heard of Linux. When I was 12, I subscribed to a magazine called Computes Gazette that about a third of it was articles, about a third of it was ads, and about a third of it was basic source listing in the end of every issue. The WWIV bulletin board is why I learned C programming, because it was shareware, and when you registered it, you got a complete copy of the C source code for DOS to be compiled in Turbo C. And there was a community of people the downside of opening all these little terminal windows ahead of time is it expects you to be a little more organized than I am. A whole bunch of files, I still have some of them. I grabbed some from 1993 at the end, where it was basically messages like this, where, you know, back up your source code, load up this file, look for this, and add that. We didn't have the patch program. We were doing open source completely on our own without being aware that there was such a thing as the patch program. I mean, some of these files, it sort of looked like someone had maybe thought of, you know, here's the key, add this line, look for this line, delete this line, ?, modify this line, you know, load lilo.c, do that to it. While still in lilo.c, in void login, search down for this thing. It's all English descriptions of these things. Now try stacking four of them, okay? You have to learn C in order to be able to deal with this sort of thing. I mean, it was huge, you know, here's this whole new function, just replace that. Some of them were like, find this function, replace it with my version of this function. Then find this other function, replace it with my version of this other function. You know, remove comment of that, replace with this one. And then at the end, there's still a little bit more, okay, we're almost finished. Here are some small changes you need to make. First, go to the beginning of xver.c and do a search for all instances of the number 58, change them to the number 51, but don't do this one. Get string 758, be careful of that one. Now save xver.c and load up bbs.c, search for case n in void dl main menu, look for n scandir with a zero at the end, make it say a one on the end, save that, hit F9 and compile, okay? This was an entire open source community that had nothing to do with Unix, okay? People will reinvent these sort of things. And I saw this long before I ever encountered Linux. So when I saw Linux, it's like, well, of course. You know, they're better at it. When I first heard about Linus Torvalds buying the Minix source from Andrew Tannenbaum's book, and then writing his own version and attracting the established community of Minix users to follow him instead because he would take their patches and integrate it into new versions of his code and come out with new releases. And Andrew Tannenbaum didn't take patches, so there was this huge backlog of accumulated, you know, stacks that you had to make work together on your own. This story made perfect sense to me. The patch pressure built up until it could ground itself out through a fork. He got a big boost from the established backlog of features that people ported to Linux when he started accepting them, because he tapped into an existing community. That community was comp.os.minix. Notice, there's been no mention of the Free Software Foundation in any of this so far. Okay, Linus was in the comp.os.minix community. I came out of the BASIC community and the WWIV community. Linus was using a no commercial license, no commercial use license until his 0.12 release. These things previously existed. It's like convergent evolution, where Australia managed to produce a rat, and it's a marsupial rat. But it looks just like other rats because it had the same pressures and the same niche. Intellectual property has also been a hobby of mine forever. I had first countered GCC and the GPL via the EMX package for OS2 around 1993. Also in 1993, that's when the four SLS disks came across FidoNet. My first exposure to Linux, I went, why would anyone clone a Sun workstation? This doesn't run DOS programs. They don't support SMP. They think threading's a bad idea. I mean, I poked at it a bit and I went, well, I'll keep tabs on it. And then I went to work for IBM doing OS2. In 1998, when I was first getting back into Linux, because OS2 was dying, and the Amiga had died, and the anything but Microsoft crowd had coalesced around Java, but Java still needed an OS to run on, and I'm going, okay, if I'm leaving OS2, where do I go? Well, I'd like to go to Linux. I'd like to make it work, even though it doesn't currently support Java. I looked around. SLS wasn't really around anymore. I remembered the word Debian and managed to search for it and found it, and they pointed me to the FSF page. It is one of the many, many tabs that I opened in preparation for this before my system went down to 1024 by 768. So look, SLS, way. I can try. Let's see, that tab is a picture of me on a panel in 2005 as the in favor of GPL v2, with other people saying that, you know, we've outgrown it, we don't need it anymore. A similar pros and cons of the GNU General Public License, where I was on the pro GPL v2 side, with Eric Raymond and Jay Maynard, who you may know as the Tron guy. He also maintains the Hercules emulator, as the against side, and saying, you know, BSD is doing stuff. There's the WWIV things, they're all on the web if you're actually interested. But in 1998, I was sort of pointed at the FSF's rant, which you can still dig out of archive.org, saying, don't call it Linux. Linux is just this transient thing that's 386 only, even though that already wasn't true because it was ported to the alpha in 1995. But they had stale information up saying that the herd will replace Linux, and I emailed Richard Stallman and said, okay, I know GNU as a tools vendor, and pretty much I think everybody knows GNU as a tools vendor, not as somebody making an OS. So if, you know, Linux has a certain amount of market recognition out there, people have heard the name. So if you want to position GNU herd as an upgrade to GNU Linux, then you have to attach the GNU name to it, like Borland did with, you know, Turbo Basic. Let them market Turbo C and Turbo Pascal, and they had the Turbo family. You have to do something like that. And Stallman sort of grabbed onto this idea and went, well, we have sometimes referred to the combination as GNU/Linux. I'll push that really hard. I would like to apologize to the world at large for starting an avalanche that I could not steer. This has happened more than once. See also the Apache Penguin post. So yes, I'm very sorry about the whole GNU/Linux thing. I was studying intellectual property law as a hobby for a decade. In May 2000, I wrote, I used to write a stock market investment column for the Motley Fool for 3 years for no readily apparent reason. It was the dot-com boom. And I did a week of stuff on intellectual property law that I bounced off the Motley Fool's lawyers because I'd been studying this stuff. And I also emailed Richard Stallman about it. And he was the one who pointed out that copyright doesn't cover use. This was before the DMCA. It got to the point where by
2003, I was actually called in as a domain expert in the SCO versus IBM case, basically acting as a sort of paralegal for a little bit. And I actually got to speak to Pamela Jones of Grocklaw on the phone. You may remember the Halloween documents and how they continued ridiculously through like Robin Hood parodies and stuff, but Halloween 9, it ain't necessarily SCO. I wrote the vast majority of that actually going through SCO's complaints line by line and going, well, one of my other hobbies is computer history. Here's how it really happened with links to primary sources. That took a month because there was an awful lot to shoot down. And in 2008, I spoke on a panel about GPL enforcement with Eben Moglen, the lawyer co-author of the GPL, and Brett Smith, the FSF, the Free Software Foundation's license enforcement guy at the time, and Jerry Allison of Samba, because Samba had gone GPL v3, and they wanted multiple perspectives on it. And through all this, you know, when I got to Linux, I was a really big fan of GPL version 2. And there's that link to that thing I showed you with the picture of me and Eric and the Tron guy. The GPL personified shut up and show me the code. It was a big legalese way of enforceably saying, shut up and show me the code. And that's all it did. You show me the code and we're good. And I could see that appealing to the open source community, because that was one of our fundamental tenets of how we operated. We also had 17 years to understand the GPL. We essentially had our own version of Bible study, where we would get the GPL and go, we're not lawyers, but what does this mean? What is actually required to comply with this? And what are all the weird little implications and possible, you know, jurisdictional things, or how enforceable would it be in these circumstances and stuff? And we weren't experts, but we only had to understand this one thing, and we could ask questions of experts, and we had a long time to only have to care about this one license. And I was a plaintiff in the first GPL license enforcement suits, the BusyBox lawsuits, because when I became BusyBox maintainer, I inherited the hall of shame that the previous maintainer, Eric Anderson, had done, that he'd gotten reports of license, you know, people shipping BusyBox without shipping source code, and his father was a lawyer, so he could get his father to write up on legal letterhead cease and desist letters, which did most of it, but if they got ignored, he didn't really have the resources to do anything more than that, so they just sort of accumulated. And I went, well, what am I going to do with this page? So I asked Pamela Jones of Grocklaw, what am I going to do with this page? And I went, is there any kind of like pro bono legal representation? And she pointed me at Eben Moglen, the co-author of the GPL in the first place, had this side project for his NYU students to give them some real-world experience. The Software Freedom Law Center, where, yes, pro bono, he would be happy to do GPL enforcement suits. And I did a year of these against a dozen companies and got involved with some side projects in Europe that took much longer to resolve. And the end result of this, you know, the side project was with FSF Europe and GPLviolations.org and all that, Harold Wolto was involved. And the end result of this was that not one line of code was added to BusyBox from any of these. When we got their code, we didn't want it. There was nothing there. And this isn't actually hugely surprising. If you look at like SquashFS, the SquashFS maintainer to finally get that into the kernel after 7 years, when it was already in Red Hat, it was already in SUSE, it was already in Debian, it was already in all of the distros, but it wasn't in vanilla. To finally get it in, he took a year off of work, unpaid, to full-time deal with everybody's comments on this thing and get it in. He posted about this to Linux Weekly News. If the net was here, I'd actually... These are all things that I queued up this morning, and then I kept thinking, oh, I should do that. Oh, I should do that. And it's like, well. There's sort of no net here. But if someone does an abandonware dump of a large, elaborate feature, and then doesn't do a lot of work to get it into the kernel, it's probably going to sit there and rot. We have a lot of, people have been trying to get union mounts into the kernel for years. This is a desperately wanted feature that there's a half dozen implementations of, and we still haven't got one because they haven't worked out precisely what VFS semantics they want. Valerie Aurora spent her last year before she went off to do the ADA initiative, she spent a year working on union mount stuff with VFS maintainer Alviro. And that's not the fork that they're currently thinking is most likely to get in. So, you know, poking people for their code, it's actually easier to reverse engineer it. And reverse engineering actually isn't that hard. We have the nouveau drivers. We have the forced ETH drivers. We have a bunch of, we have drivers for ATI cards and stuff that were reverse engineered. Usually we don't want other people's code except to read it to make specs for the hardware. What we really want is documentation for the hardware so that we can write stuff that is up to our standards. You know, code isn't that hard to write or rewrite. You know, I did BusyBox, which was a complete re-implementation of a whole bunch of stuff that the GNU guys had already done, the BSD guys had already done, and original Unix had already done. Plus, Minix had their own implementation, Coherent had their own implementation, and so on. And now, since I left BusyBox, I'm doing the ToyBox project, which is a complete rewrite of all these things that I can make it smaller and simpler than BusyBox was. You know, it's not hard. Code isn't this... Okay. So I actually did license enforcement. I'm not doing an armchair admiral thing. I actually tried all this stuff. And I'm here to tell you that it was a complete waste of time. At best. At worst, some instances of it actually may have done some damage and driven people who otherwise would have been interested in participating away from Linux entirely. That whole Cisco thing that I probably won't have time to cover. So there were instances of good GPL enforcement. GPL has done some very nice things. Opening Linksys to produce OpenWRT before I got, you know, this was just before I got involved in BusyBox. I was using it, but I wasn't contributing to it yet. What they did is they went to Linksys and said, we could sue you, but we're not going to. Let's resolve this out of court. And they actually got the code that became OpenWRT and allowed a lot of Linux stuff on routers by negotiating with them and not filing suit. In 2008, the Free Software Foundation filed suit against Cisco, which had bought Linksys by that point, about the exact same five-year-old toolchains. Basically, they'd gotten a board support package from upstream Broadcom that Cisco never got the source code to, and they basically went, we can't give you the source code to it, we don't have it. Broadcom never gave it to us. And with the negotiation that they did with the BusyBox people circa 2003, they gave out the source code they did have, which was like the source to the kernel and stuff. And, you know, we could get toolchains. The fact that you don't have the source code for a toolchain on MIPS, they're not exactly hard to come by. And that let them, you know, do OpenWRT on the routers and stuff. The Free Software Foundation came back in 2008 for a second bite at the apple and basically said, no, we need the source code to those toolchains that you don't have, and we're going to sue Cisco, not Broadcom, because you're a bigger target. I mean, you've previously showed weakness. Therefore, we're not going to sue Broadcom, we're going to sue you, because you owe us this thing that you've already said that you can't give us. And Cisco's response was to get out of the Linux business. entirely. I was actually working with the Linksys developers to try to come up with ways they could be more, ways they could be nicer to the open source community. One of the things was that one of their upcoming routers, the WRT510N, had these little debug adapters that let you get a serial console on them, but they'd only have ever manufactured 50 of them. And it's like, no, go back, do a production run of 1,000 and give them out at Ottawa Linux Symposium. Because that will give you huge amounts of, you know, Linux guys working on this thing. All the developers in the Linksys division were reassigned to work on iOS or on Windows, and most of them quit the company within the next 6 months because Cisco basically went, we don't want to get any of that on us. That was and plus, the code that the FSF was going after was stuff that nobody needed, and it was just, this was an example of being hugely counterproductive. It is possible for a GPL enforcement suit, even if you are technically in the right legally, to not be doing, there's no potential upside in terms of advancing any engineering purpose. Tangent. So the GPL was synonymous with copyleft. You know, the point of this whole talk is the rise and fall of the GPL. The GPL was a copyleft category killer. It was a single standard license. It was a unique terminal node in a directed graph of license convertibility. There were a whole bunch of other licenses. You know, there was LGPL. There were the Mozilla license in its later versions. You could relicense it to GPL. Some versions of BSD could be relicensed to GPL. Some versions of things like Apache could be relicensed to GPL. And everything, if you were a developer mostly working with GPL code, all you cared about is it convertible to GPL or not? If it is, treat it as GPL, because I know the characteristics of this one license. If it's not, ignore it, because I can't incorporate it into my project that is GPL. And we're done. We can stop thinking. We don't have to be lawyers. We don't have to be domain experts. There was a giant pool of compatibly licensed code that we could reuse without fear. There was a universal receiver that once code was GPL, it stayed GPL. You know? One of the things about programmers not having to be lawyers is that we're really bad at being lawyers. And to point this out, there's a lot of programmers in this room, I'm guessing, right? You know when non-security guys try to do security and they say, oh, this system is secure. I've never plugged anything into the internet, but this system is secure. And it's not. It's totally not. These days, most people kind of have to have a basic knowledge of security, although we don't do the full audit of trying to find vulnerabilities and stuff. But imagine, you know, cryptography is a thing that we've mostly had to deal with, and you've hopefully learned enough to know that if you are not a cryptographer and you think you've come up with a new cryptography algorithm or you've rolled your own cryptography, the only reason it hasn't been broken yet is that the relevant domain expert hasn't bothered to look at it. And that's the only reason. Okay? Caring deeply about something is not the same as being good at it. For example, 76% of the Tor nodes are using 1024-bit Diffie-Hellman keys, which we know the NSA can brute force with $1 billion worth of equipment and about 24 hours of compute time. We know that just from the math. So, but that's still 3/4 of Tor. They care very, very deeply about this. That's not the same thing as being good at it. Imagine application developers doing system programming. If you've ever had someone who mostly does GUI development and they submit code to the kernel, it's going to suck. The flip side of that is the lovely user interface that the kernel developers put on Git, We're currently on the third iteration of the Git user interface because the previous two were worse. Okay, so domain expertise is important. Domain expertise is important. And so imagine what non-cryptographers think of other people trying to do cryptography is the same thing that non-intellectual property lawyers think of other lawyers who do like real estate law or something reaching over and messing with intellectual property. It's like, you're not a security expert, you're not a cryptography expert. Well, yes, you're a programmer, but not this bit. It's the same, lawyers have the same domain expertise of, you're a lawyer, but you're not an intellectual property lawyer. So what you say about this is sort of 70% right. Now imagine what they think about non-lawyers saying anything about intellectual property law. We're lucky to get anything right. It really is its own, it's its own category of expertise within which it has its own domain expertise. Anything will seem simple if you don't do it. Okay? Your manager is sure that programming is easy because they have never encountered significant problems with programming. Okay? We had domain expertise in one license. Some of us spent a very long time learning this one thing, and we were parroting half of it, that what experts had told us, but we knew what to do with this one area. We knew the GPL. Problem, there's no such thing as the GPL anymore. There's no more universal receiver. The Linux kernel and Samba are both GPL. They implement two ends of the same protocol, and they can't share code because the kernel is GPLv2, Samba is GPLv3 or later, and those are incompatible licenses. Trivially, it seems, well, the obvious solution is GPLv2 or later, but a project that's GPLv2 or later can't accept code from either source. You can't accept GPLv2 only code because you don't have the or later. You can't accept GPLv3 or later code because you can't use it under GPL2. So there's no more universal receiver. Instead, you have incompatible factions. And you know, projects like QEMU are stuck between wanting to take GPLv2 code from kernel drivers so that they can turn them inside out and make device emulations out of them. And it wants to accept binutils or GDB code that describes processor instruction sets so that they can implement processor emulation. Well, one of those is GPLv2 only, one of them is GPLv3 or later. It can't accept both. They're stuck in the middle. They went with GPLv2 only for the larger project because they already had a lot of kernel code in there, but subdirectories, you know, the TCG subdirectory is BSD licensed. A lot of individual files will say, well, this file you can take, you know, V2 or later, so if you want to take this file and use it in a V3 project, you can, but it's every once in a while there's a message on the list that it's time to clean up all the license messages again, and I would feel a little nervous about sourcing anything from a project that was not under the license of the project. You know, a little funky. So, you know, being GPLv2 or later doesn't help, and there are sort of subtle problems because a lot of people who don't do licensing and are not license experts, you know, take code from a source that's GPLv2 and send it to you. And when someone said this patch is GPLv2, well, you sometimes have to stop and ask questions. Where did it come from? You know, you have to police the source to go, well, okay, no, I'm sorry, you can't lift it out of Samba and put it in BusyBox. It doesn't work. Yeah, I know it's GPL. Doesn't work. Um, Another subtle thing that people don't necessarily notice is that LGPL V3 is not compatible with GPL V2 because LGPL V3 is convertible to GPL V3 but not GPL V2. There was a plan for a while to switch glibc to LGPL V3 until people pointed out then you couldn't distribute Git binaries built against glibc anymore. That would be a problem. The motivations for coming out with GPL V3, the main one they put out is anti-TiVoization, which is basically, burning it into a ROM is okay, but if you have the ability to upgrade it, then we need the ability to upgrade it. So it's best if you burn it into ROM and cut the JTAG traces and stuff to prevent legal liability. Because if you make the device more hackable, is this really what we want to encourage? There's also, they're trying to make a distinction that says, okay, GPL V3 software is on this device, therefore I need to be able to upgrade it, but if I have an account, if I have a World of Warcraft account, the World of Warcraft server is running, GPL V3 software that I contributed to, do you owe me your root password so that I can update that software on the World of Warcraft server? How do I write the license so that I'm splitting this hair the way they mean? Being up against an entire world of lawyers that want to screw us over on this sort of stuff. None of this addresses, if I want to run arbitrary code on an Xbox or on a PlayStation 3 or something like that, I need to mod chip it. Is that legal? People have been arrested for mod chipping their own Xbox 360. The FSF is not really fighting that fight. I drove to interview, one of my hobbies is computer history, and I drove to interview Richard Stallman in 2001, drove to Boston. And one of the questions I asked him is, why isn't the FSF doing anything about software patents? And he said, it's not our fight. They changed their mind later, but they're not always focused on the things the rest of us are. One of the things that GPL V3 was motivated for is international jurisdictions, which is something that even if you spent 17 years studying this and you're not a lawyer, you pretty much just have to trust them about international jurisdictions because there's hundreds of them and you will never be a domain expert in what's required in Fiji. The other thing is, I've done license enforcement. I'm not suing anybody in Fiji. It's logistically very difficult. So what good would it do to have nominal license enforcement in a jurisdiction where I've had to deal with engineers in Taiwan that didn't speak English, that were willing to help me, get files for an obsolete board support package that they'd stopped doing several months ago. But I couldn't find anybody who had the relevant technical knowledge who actually spoke English. Just logistically, I couldn't get in touch with the right people. And one of the problems is that the patent situation is so incredibly insane that what they were doing for a while, they might still be, I'm a little out of the loop, is they would have a shell company that was owned by a shell company, so on, several layers. The shell company would get some funding, would start up, would do a product, would make 100,000 or whatever it was, do one production run of the product, push it into the resale inventory channel, dissolve, pump the money upstream to whoever the owner was, and then all the contractors who'd been hired for a year would scatter and go work somewhere else. So that by the time the device hit retail shelves and people started looking at it for patent violations and tried to sue over it, the company in question hadn't existed for 9 months. And so you're finding a defunct company that was owned by a defunct shell company that was owned by a defunct shell company at least five layers deep before you find whatever large, often Fortune 500 company had done this. And it's like, they were trying to make it so that it wasn't worth the trouble of digging to go after the patent violations. They weren't thinking about dodging GPL or anything like that, but if we have to, you know, if we have a board support package for this thing that there's no source for, we have the exact same problem. So, you know, international jurisdiction, really fun. The best you could hope for is through the grapevine, finding an engineer who used to work at that who might have a personal copy of stuff. But mostly, again, you just need a certain amount of information documenting the hardware, and then you can write the code yourself. You really don't want their code, because their code is disgusting, because they did it on a very short deadline, knowing that it would never be looked at again by anybody, because the whole company is being buried in a sea trench in 3 months. So the real motivation for GPL v3 coming out is that the FSF was worried it was becoming politically irrelevant. And there's some history behind this that I'll get to in a bit. The actual market need for a new GPL v3, GPL v2 had a lifeboat clause. The or later thing, we can come out with new versions, was initially intended if the GPL was ever found not enforceable in court. If there was something wrong with it, they could fix it. There was nothing wrong with GPL v2. I was successfully enforcing it. It's just that they changed what their goals were. And not everybody agreed with these goals. Because the ability to, you know, install, I mean, you may have heard about phones with kill fuses, which is a really, really stupid idea. But, you know, GPL v3 isn't really going to directly address this. If a company has decided to do something that stupid, what you're doing is excluding your software from being deployed on this platform. Okay. So before we beat up on the FSF too much, let's talk about good things that the GPL actually did. Okay? One of the things that the GPL actually did is it prevented your developers from being hired away. In 1969, Unix was created. 1974 to 1975, Ken Thompson, the creator of Unix, took a year off to teach at his alma mater, the University of California at Berkeley. And he taught an entire generation of grad students, you know, Unix. 1979, the ARPANET that became the internet was replacing its first generation routers, and they decided that they wanted to use Unix on VAXes, and they came to Berkeley, and the end result was that Bill Joy wrote a new network stack. He didn't really mean to, but he wrote a much better one to piss off the Wolfranek and Newman guys. And that network stack was distributed with the Berkeley software distribution and became a whole Unix distribution, sort of because they just kept modifying more and more parts of the original Unix that they got from Ken Thompson until they completely replaced the whole thing. And in 1982, you know, so BSD became the way everybody attached to the net. Because you get a VAX, you get the network card that goes in the VAX, and you run BSD Unix on the VAX that has the network stack, and that is the easy way to attach to the internet. So as the internet grew, you know, Unix became very widely distributed, and in 1982, Sun Microsystems hired away Bill Joy, the guy who had written that network code, and who was the maintainer of BSD at the time, hired him away to become one of the four founders of Sun Microsystems. They basically threw money at him to work on a proprietary fork of the open version that he'd been doing before. In the late 80s, you know, 89 or 90 or so, Berkeley shut down the Computer Science Research Group, and BSDI hired away a bunch of the guys who, you know, and Kirk McCusick is here, and he lived through all this and knows far more about this than I do, so I'm waiting for him to jump up and go, that's wrong! But in the late 80s, a second wave of BSD experts was hired away to work on a proprietary fork, And this actually screwed up the open source 386 introduction because Bill Jolits was working on it and had to do some legal clearance dancing in order to get permission. It delayed the release because his employer sort of grabbed what he was working on in his spare time. In 1997, Apple hired away Jordan Hubbard, one of the founders of FreeBSD, to become one of the founders of Mac OS X. That's an oversimplification because Mac OS X was a port of Next and so on, but thing. He hired away Jordan Hubbard to work full-time on FreeBSD. And you can basically go, oh, this thing that you're doing for fun, come work on that exact same thing and we'll pay you a lot of money. And of course you'll be able to contribute to the open version on evenings and weekends. We just won't tell you that we're going to work you 90 hours a week for the next 2 years until the version you're working on and the version you used to work on don't look at all like anymore and the urge to work on the old one has faded. This happened multiple times to BSD. It never happened to Linux because you couldn't hire away Alan Cox to work on a proprietary fork of Linux because it was GPL. As soon as you release the binaries, you have to release the source. You can't have a persistent proprietary version. The failure to distribute source code is up until you ship at most. So that was a pragmatic effect of the GPL potential. However, Apache worked just fine without that. Apache has been more or less BSD licensed. They came up with their own Apache license. But Apache didn't need the GPL to prevent forking. In fact, Apache did fork several times. No one cared. Because they were able to defend their niche, and the forks died off, and the open source version continued on. The GPL also acted as a flag to rally around. It was a statement of values, you know, that shut up and show me the code is legally enforceable. But at the same time, we tended not to exercise it. I mean, I did the first GPL enforcement lawsuits in 2006. Linux was 15 years old at that point. Nobody had actually sued. There'd been a little bit of saber rattling, but mostly we didn't. What did the GPL not do? The Cathedral and the Bazaar actually was comparing Linus Torvalds' working style with Richard Stallman's working style. It wasn't Linux versus Microsoft, it was Linux versus the Free Software Foundation. When Eric did the 1997 Usenix paper, he had been the Emacs Lisp maintainer for a couple of years and had had huge problems as a maintainer getting patches upstream. And he wrote a thing, you know, going, nobody had trouble at the time getting patches upstream into Linux because Linus rapidly took them, did the release early, release often thing, and he did a paper about that. I've got a section on why Linux succeeded in a way that, you know, none of these things have to do, and let me skip into that because I'm running out of time, actually. Linux, I mentioned that it forked off of the Minix project and inherited a large active user base of people. Another thing that happened was that in 1993, the National Science Foundation changed its Internet Backbone Acceptable Use policy to say you could have for-profit ISPs hooked up to the internet. This gave us AOL in the September that never ended. It also gave us GeoCities. The Free Software Foundation, when it did its initial 1983 announcement of the GNU project, Richard Stallman was actually responding to he was really responding to the Jupiter project having been canceled and the PDP-10 going away. But proprietary software had just been invented by the Apple versus Franklin decision. Bill Gates did his letter to hobbyists in 1976, and it had no effect. He lobbied Congress in 1980, actually, of an MP3 of him ranting about how, you know, copyright should cover binaries, and it really does. It's just all these judges and lawyers and stuff don't see it my way. Because a binary was just a number. Source code, human-readable source code, copyright applied to that, but it didn't apply to binaries for about the same reason that Intel had to rename its had to rename its 586 the Pentium, because they couldn't trademark a number. You know, a binary was just a number. It's not human-readable, therefore copyright doesn't apply to it. So you can't stop someone from pirating a binary. Then Franklin, the makers of the Speak and Spell, the thing that ET phoned home with, did an Apple II clone. And they copied the Apple ROMs verbatim, including the names of the programmers and their little Easter eggs and the word AppleSoft and all these kind of things. And the district court said, well, yeah, copyright doesn't cover binaries. They're allowed to do that. But the appeals court said, I'm not quite sure where the line is, but I think these guys are over it because this is pretty egregious. And they found against Franklin and changed the law. So there wasn't proprietary software before 1983. There was no copyright enforcement that could be done on binaries. And this is why, you know, Stallman has his story of the Xerox printer that wouldn't give him the driver anymore. AT&T, in part, allowed itself to be broken up to get into the computer business to commercialize Unix. He had a couple other reasons. IBM, one of the... If I can find the IBM's object code only announcement. Oh, here we go. The IBM object. Okay, this is the IBM user group complaining 5 years later that the object code only announcement was this big change and it was an evil thing. This is the actual announcement that IBM did that said, we're not going to be shipping source code anymore, we're going to be shipping binaries now. And this was a big change, and it was new. And the Free Software Foundation's founding, saying, you know, we are going to return to the glorious past of the 1970s, was a conservative reactionary movement saying, these changes in the industry, we don't like change. It wasn't a big visionary thing saying, we have this grand plan for the future. It was digging their heels in and saying, we won't go. The thing about cloning Unix, the first clone of Unix was Coherent in 1979. And Dennis Ritchie went and looked at Coherent and said, it's not cloned. It's all their own code. We can't, you know, copyright did cover source code. So, but we can't sue them for copying our source code. Minix, the thing that Andrew Tannenbaum did, because when AT&T commercialized Unix and closed it up, he couldn't use it as a teaching tool anymore, so he wrote his own Unix clone as a teaching tool. Coherent had its own C compiler called Let's C. BSD had its own C compiler. TinyCC started as an entry into the obfuscated C code contest in 2002, and by 2004 it was building the Linux kernel with TCC boot. I actually have a copy of that up here. This is, you know, TCC boot having booted. The point of this is that the FSF's grand vision of the future was restoring the status quo before the Apple versus Franklin decision in 1983. And one of the things about the Apple versus Franklin decision in 1983, the invention of proprietary code, turns out it sort of runs its course. The invention of proprietary code caused a gold rush. All these companies getting in and going, I will get rich. Nobody really makes a software company to sell shrink-wrapped software these days with the idea that they're going to get rich selling PC software, because there's all this abandonware. You know, WordPerfect, RotorBund, you know, anybody here still using Lotus 1-2-3? There were lots and lots of programs that, even if you liked them, you can't still use the Borland compiler. I mean, some of them were later open sourced as, you know, abandonware. The Wacom compiler is open source now, but the company that was there has sort of gone away. And the BSD guys have always sort of said that proprietary software is something we can outweight. Now, there's a big transition into the industry going on right now that smartphones are replacing the PC the way that, you know, there were mainframes, then there were mini computers, then there were microcomputers, now they're smartphones. It's the fourth iteration of the thing. Each one kicks the previous one up into the server space. This time that's called the cloud. It has a marketing budget. They're making like it's a big deal. But we've seen it before. And you're going to get your phone, it's got USB on the end, plug it into a USB hub, add a USB keyboard, a USB mouse, and a USB to HDMI adapter, and you've got a workstation. The rest is just software. But the dominant ones there are Android and iPhone. iPhone is purely proprietary. Android has a policy of no GPL in user space. And part of the reason they have a policy of no GPL in user space is they didn't want to get any of GPL v3 on them. Mac OS X was using GCC until version 4.2.1, the last GPL v2 version. When GCC went GPL v3, they started the LLVM project. The GPL has been fragmented. I have half the thing left, but I'm out of time. I have a whole lot more history and stuff. I may post it to the web or something, but the point is that the GPL was big and growing, but these days the most common license on GitHub is no license specified. In the absence of a universal receiver, pretty much everybody under the age of 30 is switching over to universal donor. An awful lot of them are taking the Napster approach and not specifying a license at all and saying that copyright is as screwed up as patents are and we just have to wait it out. Because all these people doing, you know, DMCA takedown notices on every remix of every song people ever post, you know, there's this cultural thing of, you know, that's wrong and the system just needs to collapse. And GPL v3 is essentially saying we'd like to extend copyright, give it sharper teeth so that we can enforce more stuff and we can actually rely on elements of the DMCA and stuff like that. And a lot of the younger developers are basically saying, whose side are you on? Is that really what you want to do? So things like 7-zip are public domain. When I started on the Commodore 64, it came with a disk of public domain software. That, you know, I have been doing open source all along, and I was convinced along the way that public domain was bad. Public domain was not sustainable. If I ship public domain software without this, you know, over half of the BSD license is a disclaimer saying, don't sue me if I spill hot coffee on your lap. You know, but at the same time, I could get sued over patents. How's that different? So the resurgence of public domain software that we've been seeing and the surge in just not specifying a license at all is because we have lost the new generation of people who would have gone to who would have gone with the GPL when there was the GPL. Now that there's no such thing as the GPL, we collectively have to figure out what to do going forward. Because this split is not fixing itself. People are adding, I will ship software under Creative Commons, I will ship software under, you know, maybe the Afro GPL. People keep trying to come up with new ones to fix this, and you don't fix factionalization by adding more factions. Okay? So, questions, we got like 30 seconds. Yes? The problem was when I started, I had 12 hours of material, and as of this morning, I cut it down to 3 hours. I rushed. Sorry, it showed. Any others?
Do you have the slides up online somewhere?
I will put them up online. They'll be on landly.net/talks. And I'll poke the event notifiers, and they'll link it from the Ohio Linux website. Yes? Public domain.
Okay.
Or one of the BSDs. In the absence of universal receiver, people are going to universal donor. And it makes sense, because there isn't a universal receiver anymore. I was an enormous fan of GPLv. I was an enormous fan of the GPL. There's no the GPL anymore. It took me 5 years to come to terms with that. I had to go through the stages of grieving. Okay? Thank you.